On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mr. Brian Shee here. Curtis takes us down memory lane and talks about his personal experiences with a tech and IT visionary. Plus, we have a great guest. He's the CEO of Disco, Kiwi Kamara, on the show. He's going to take us through the advanced world of e-discovery and how it's helping businesses and lawyers alike. Shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 426, recorded January 15th, 2021. Legal Disco. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Smart Deploy. With Smart Deploy, IT can manage PCs from anywhere. Leverage your existing network or cloud infrastructure to deploy Windows, apps, BIOS updates, and more. Set up and start managing PCs in an afternoon. Claim your free subscription for up to 15 machines, a $575 value, at smartdeploy.com/twit. And by Worldwide Technology. WWT's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like HPE and Intel. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to WWT.com/twit. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the A-team, the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior analyst at Omdia. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend? And how is the great state of Florida treating you?
Well, the Sunshine State is in pretty good shape. It's wintertime down here, so our high is only going up into the mid-50s. But that makes it perfect for staying inside and looking at the cybersecurity industry, enjoying really digging into my role as a senior analyst at Omdia, have some research that I'm going to be talking about in the coming months, as well as lots of takes on what companies should be doing to respond to some of the news that's out there. So it's good to take a break, be on Twit, charge up my batteries for the rest of the week.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you, Curtis, for being here. Well, speaking of busy, we have Mr. Brian Shee on. He's the net architect at Sky Fiber and also the geek in paradise for just a short bit more time. Welcome back, Chibert. Always great to see you. How's things going over there down in Hawaii?
It's good. It's cooled off a little bit. It's into the mid-70s as opposed to what Kurt's doing. Tomorrow, a box truck backs up into my home full of rented furniture so that the interior designer can stage the house for the professional photographer. So my time in paradise is shorter. And hopefully I'll be Curtis Franklin's neighbor in Orlando, Florida before too long.
Fantastic. Good luck on the move. Well, the new year has definitely presented us no short of news in the enterprise. So we're going to mix it up a bit today in the bites because one of our hosts has some past experiences with a true visionary in the IT field, and he's going to take us a bit down memory lane. Plus, we have a great guest. He's the CEO of Disco, Kiwi Kamara. He's on the show, and he's going to take us through the advanced world of e-discovery and how it's helping businesses and lawyers alike. But it's been a busy week in the IT news, so let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Well, this week I wanted to start with something we are more familiar with, the ebook industry. Now, it's a place where not only legitimate publishers and self-publishers alike can share their content with the world. It seems like a true capitalist environment, doesn't it? Well, this past week, several ebook customers filed a lawsuit against Amazon. They accused them of violating antitrust laws by illegally conspiring with the big five publishing houses to drive up ebook prices. Say it ain't so. Now think about this. The company that conceived the inexpensive book ebook industry is now trying to make more money out of it. Think about that. Now, a lawsuit claimed that Amazon entered into anti-competitive pricing agreements in 2015 with Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin Random House, and Simon & Schuster, allowing the companies to increase prices as much as 30%, artificially. And the lawsuit calls out that Amazon controls 89% of the ebook market as of 2018, and it used its dominance to benefit from those price hikes by charging consumers more. Now, the lawsuit claimed that Amazon illegally inflated prices using a tactic called as pricing parity, which relies on most favored nation clauses. Now, in business context, MFNs are agreements between both buyers and sellers that ensure a buyer gets as good deal as the seller's products as any other buyer in the market. Now, the lawsuit accused Amazon of using MFNs to instead prevent publishers from selling their ebooks to consumers at a lower price on websites that compete with Amazon. Now, get this. The EU actually reached an agreement with Amazon in 2015 over its use of MFNs, saying that the time that the practice, quote, may have made it more difficult for other ebook platforms to innovate and compete effectively with Amazon. Now, the agreement barred the practice for 5 years, but only in the EU. Now, the lawsuit filed in the Southern District of New York has sought class action status. Plaintiffs are asking for the court to reimburse consumers who were overcharged by Amazon competitors due to alleged price fixing and force Amazon and the publishers to abandon the practice. Although the plaintiffs may not win here because they're going up against a big giant here, it's good that consumers are willing to stand up on tech companies. At least it will make them think twice next time when they try to make more money on money-making schemes.
Speaking of money-making schemes, malware authors are changing their tactics, and it's working. Companies relaxed security controls to help employees be more productive during the coronavirus pandemic, leading attackers to shift their tactics and take advantage of the chaos caused by remote work. This is according to a report published by cloud security firm Wandera. Compared with pre-pandemic times, employees were twice as likely to connect to inappropriate content during work hours and more likely to continue accessing email after being compromised with mobile malware. As a result, attackers have shifted their attacks to the weekends. 41% more organizations experienced a malware infection on an employee's remote device as a result. At their peak, Wandera's data shows that 6% more attacks happened on Saturdays than on any other day. Many analysts, such as those at PricewaterhouseCoopers, have indicated that the move to remote work is going to last long after the pandemic ends. The president of Wandera expects that as well because most organizations and workers believe that the greater flexibility that comes with working from home has improved their approach to work. Now, this is not all bad news. Wandera found some indications that workers are taking responsibility for their security. In 2020, for example, only half as many devices, or 3%, had their lock screens disabled, and only 4% used a risky hotspot in any given week. That's down from 7% in 2019.
Well, China has been tossing some obstacles at the WHO team investigating the pandemic's origin. According to an article from Ars Technica, Chinese authorities have held up two scientists sent to Wuhan, China, by the World Health Organization to investigate the origins of the novel coronavirus. Yet another obstacle the Chinese government has thrown at the health agency's efforts to understand how the devastating pandemic began. The two scientists were traveling as part of an international team of 15 that has long been working to gain access to the city where the virus first emerged in late 2019. 13 of the scientists, who all repeatedly tested negative for the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 in their home countries, were allowed to travel on. They have now arrived in Wuhan, the WHO said on Twitter earlier the other day. However, China is still requiring the 13 scientists to undergo a 14-day quarantine in Wuhan. The two scientists held back also tested negative for the virus multiple times prior to traveling, but while in Singapore en route to Wuhan, they tested positive for the SARS-CoV-2 antibodies, suggesting past exposure to the virus. Despite their negative PCR test, Chinese authorities had them remain in Singapore for additional testing. So, while I am certainly in no position to cast doubt as to the motivations of the mainland Chinese authorities, I do wonder why they aren't falling over themselves to prove their innocence. With the cost of the pandemic rising into what is more than likely trillions of dollars, this hot potato will continue to be in the news for quite a while.
Now, public cloud and infrastructure professionals and managed service providers, or MSPs, is actually a very large market. Now, Taos is a player in this market. They have a strong background in delivering highly customized professional and managed cloud services. Now, despite being a small vendor with sales presence only in North America, they are a niche market player in this area. Now, it seems it caught the eye of a big tech company because IBM has announced agreeing to acquire cloud-focused MSP Taos. Now, according to IBM, quote, Taos adds the deep enterprise, public cloud partnerships, and innovative solutions needed to drive growth and adoption of IBM's hybrid cloud platform throughout the Americas. Now, that's the key to call out here. It's interesting to actually hear that IBM wants to only focus on the Americas here. Now, the platform gives enterprises the freedom to choose from multiple providers to meet their business needs and IT needs. Now, IBM wants to be committed to helping clients successfully navigate their hybrid cloud journeys with those specific providers. Now, based in San Jose in California, Taos is a 30-year-old company with in its hands technology, financial services, healthcare, retail, transportation, and education sectors. Now, the deal's financial details were not disclosed, and the transaction is subject to the customary closing conditions. Now, it's penciled for the completion in the first quarter of 2021. Now, earlier this week, IBM also announced acquiring Salesforce's consultancy provider, Seven Summits, to advance the firm's Salesforce cloud and AI ambitions. Now, it seems to me IBM is attempting to pivot its businesses and become a significant player in the customized cloud and application offerings by using acquisitions to do so. Now, with these strategic purchases, IBM might be able to pull ahead in the cloud consulting and services market.
Well, the NSA has recommended that we only use designated DNS resolvers. A lot of people don't realize that NSA has multiple missions. One of them, of course, is looking into international communications, while another is making recommendations on best practices for cybersecurity. As part of that second mission, the NSA has issued an advisory recommending that enterprises employ only their designated DNS resolver for DNS traffic and avoid third-party resolvers, which could place data at risk. The NSA said that encrypted domain name systems technology, also known as DNS over HTTPS, can be abused by attackers if it's not properly deployed in an enterprise. Using only the organization's designated enterprise DNS server for both encrypted and unencrypted DNS traffic is the safest route. The NSA says all other DNS resolvers should be disabled and blocked. DNS, of course, converts domain names into IP addresses on the internet, and it's become an increasingly popular attack vector. The NSA published new guidelines for rolling out DNS over HTTPS securely. It's called Adopting Encrypted DNS in Enterprise Environments, and it outlines the importance of configuring enterprise networks appropriately to add benefits to and not hinder their DNS security controls. These enterprise DNS controls can prevent numerous threat techniques used by cyber threat actors for initial access, command and control, and exfiltration, says the NSA.
Well, Qualcomm is at it again. They're planning on acquiring a chip company founded by a bunch of Apple execs for a cool $1.4 billion. Chipmaker Qualcomm announced a major acquisition the other day. It will buy Santa Clara-based silicon company Nuvia for $1.4 billion. Qualcomm intends to use Nuvia's technology and future chip designs for a wide range of services from phones to cars. Nuvia was founded in 2019 by three former Apple semiconductor executives. The startup has been developing custom CPU core designs for servers, and its company materials make frequent reference to mission to reimagine silicon design. But Qualcomm sees applications for Nuvia's tech beyond servers. Qualcomm's press release goes on to say Nuvia will deliver step function improvements in CPU performance and power efficiency to meet the demands of next generation 5G computing. Qualcomm plans to use Nuvia's tech in, quote, flagship smartphones, next generation laptops, and digital cockpits, as well as advanced driver assistance systems, extending reality and infrastructure networking solutions. Ars Technica is billing this as the battle of the ARM chips. And I, for one, can certainly see some really serious computing power appearing in mobile devices everywhere.
Now, we continue to hear about some of the successes and epic failures of the self-driving and autonomous vehicle industry. Now, some of the crash standards that are out there today required by the government prevent some of these companies from actually innovating and capitalizing on their technology quickly. Now, this past week, the administration said it would be issuing new rules that would allow manufacturers of automated vehicles to bypass some crash standards required for conventional cars, which could cut down on production costs. Now, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said the rules would exempt from specific crash standards automated vehicles that are designed to carry only goods, not people. Whew, I was worried there. Now, the new rules issued after months of deliberation would also give a freer hand to manufacturers of passenger-carrying autonomous vehicles to design vehicles without standard controls, including steering wheels. Now, the first time the agency has taken a significant move to remove barriers to the deployment of vehicles without traditional human controls, including eliminating the requirement that self-driving vehicles have a driver's seat. Is anyone else envisioning maybe people hiding in some of these vehicles to get from point A to point B? Yeah, I definitely am. Now, the NHTSA estimated its rule would save automated vehicle manufacturers up to $5.8 billion in the year 2050, or about $995 per vehicle based on the estimated production of about 5.8 million vehicles. Now, small changes like these to modernize law requirements might be enough for the tech industry to move forward. This just might be the year of supply chain autonomous vehicles. Never know. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the pretty good bright to talk through. But before we get to that bite, we do want to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Smart Deploy. Now, you're probably already doing a lot to manage your remote endpoints, whether it's disk cloning, semantic ghost, or even using Microsoft SCCM. But reimaging machines and application deployment is time consuming. It's timeless. You can make sure you're always updating your drivers and your versions and everything else. Well, Smart Deploy is a top rated IT solution trusted by organizations worldwide to securely manage millions of on-site and remote endpoints. Now, suppose that isn't enough to convince you, then listen to this. They continue to receive the high performer and easiest to use GT awards. Smart Deploy enables centralized management for IT and maximum productivity for end users. Now, you're probably familiar with the legacy way of doing things here, where you had to create a disk image for every device you need to manage. Just think of all the drivers. Oh, I don't want to even think about it. It makes me cringe. Now, their layered endpoint technology and architecture enables single image management of Windows OS and applications for businesses. Now, you build a golden image that will work on any Windows hardware. That sounds like a dream, right? Well, instead of a monolithic model-specific PC image, Smart Deploy provides simplified management of the driver layer, operating system layer, application layer, and user data layer efficiently for complete flexibility and management convenience. Now, you can deploy, upgrade, and manage any PC in your organization from one centralized library, regardless of the manufacturer model. It includes a pre-built driver library, also ensures every device works as the OEM intended, which is actually really a lifesaver. Now, Smart Deploy gives you the flexibility to deploy securely offline or in the cloud. Now, they also have a ton of other really great features. Listen to this. They have hardware independent computer imaging, which means that you can manage 10 to 50 or more computers without any extra time or effort. Streamline your image library with centralized single image management. Plus, they have device driver automation, which means they handle the driver layer for your endpoints automatically with a patented driver injection technology. Plus, they offer cloud service integration. They integrate with Box, Dropbox, Google Drive, and Microsoft OneDrive to give IT the flexibility to deliver Windows images, applications, and driver updates to remote and work from home users without a corporate network connection or VPN at an endpoint. Now, they also offer Windows My Creation. Smart Deploy removes that extra hassle you've had of migration projects. You know, all of you probably tried that before, and it's just not an easy process. And it also offers application deployment. I have managed teams that have tried to get app deployment right, and it takes weeks to test in UAT environments and verify the impact of updates and then see how it disrupts the users. Well, Smart Deploy application deployment deploys third-party applications and patches to any computer, zero touch, without interrupting the end user. Think about that. Now, remote IT automation as well. They save time and effort by running tasks and scripts remotely on any endpoint without leaving your desk. Start deploying Windows images, applications, silent tasks, BIOS updates, and more within just a few hours of using it. No expensive infrastructure to purchase and configure, no lengthy consulting agreements, you know what I'm talking about, and no drawn-out and tedious training for your IT staff. Don't take my word for it. Corey R. in Illinois had this to say, "What a lifesaver. Goodbye, Microsoft SCCM and MDT forever." You'll get step-by-step wizards, automation of complicated tasks like SysPrep, and built-in best practices that make it easy for technicians of any skill to find success with Smart Deploy. We have a great deal for all of our audience. It makes it so you can just go out there right now and try it just to see what you're missing out on. Claim your free subscription for up to 15 machines, a $575 value, exclusively for the TWIT audience at smartdeploy.com/TWIT for life. Or download their fully functioning trial to try it today. Go to smartdeploy.com/TWIT. And we thank Smart Deploy for their support of this week Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, that brings us to this week's Bytes. Now, we have a special treat for you because Curtis is going to take you through some personal accounts and memories about a tech and IT industry visionary. Curtis?
Thanks, Lou. I appreciate it. You know, once upon a time, the industry was filled with colorful individuals. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about many of them in a few minutes, but I want to talk about one. Back in the early 80s, I was in graduate school, and the first job I was hired for coming out of graduate school was to manage conferences for a series of shows called the Byte Computer Shows. And I was, in addition, a conference manager for a computer show called Comdex, a networking show called Interface. The man who owned all of those shows and who I worked for was named Sheldon Adelson. Sheldon passed away this week, known more for his roles in gambling. He was the owner of Las Vegas Sands. He expanded that to Macau and to Hong Kong. And he was deeply involved in politics, donating millions upon millions of dollars to one political party. What I remember, though, was when he was running the largest computer show in the world. Now, interestingly enough, this week was also virtual CES, the show that has come to take over Comdex's place as the largest electronics-oriented show that happens in Las Vegas. But back in the early 80s, before the days of selling on the internet, before the internet was available to you if you weren't working for the government or at a research institution, and long before it was legal to conduct any business on the internet, computers were sold by dealers. Every year, those dealers would find out what the latest computers were, what the latest printers were, the latest modems. And this was, by the way, in the days when we were just getting into 1200 BPS modems, soon to be supplanted by 2400 BPS. And we thought we were flying. But hundreds of thousands of people would come to Las Vegas, meet face-to-face to hear about what was coming up in the coming months, to sign deals to resell that hardware and the software. If you look back, it's really something of a miracle that the industry developed the way it did. I remember the year before I went to work for Sheldon, there was a fire at the MGM Grand. The MGM Grand Hotel caught fire, and in a tragic instance, a number of people lost their lives when the locks on the counting cages for the casino defaulted to closed, trapping many people inside. what many people don't know is that that happened on the first day of COMDEX. And so the computer industry, as it existed then, the personal computer industry, was in Las Vegas, many of them staying at the MGM. The next morning, a lot of the booth staff, a lot of the salespeople, the engineers, the booth staff came to the convention center in clothes that were still smelling of the smoke, having lost the rest of the clothes that they came with to the fire in the tower. Sheldon sent his show manager around with wads of $100 taken from petty cash to hand out to people in the booths on the show floor, telling them to go get clean clothes and get what they needed to clean up. This was, by the way, at a time when $100 would buy you enough to get cleaned up and a couple of sets of clothes. It was an amazing time when at one of these shows, you could quite easily see Michael Dell, Bill Gates, and even Steve Jobs walking the show floor. I remember being at parties at night when one or more of these individuals would be there just talking like regular human beings. The industry has changed. It changed first when many of the sales went to mail order. This was really the rise of the Dell era. This saw the move away from computer dealers to publications like Computer Shopper, which were often 600 to 800 pages of ads for computer dealers offering to sell you things via the mail. And then, of course, in the early 90s, things changed again when everything went to the internet. Through all of this, COMDEX, a computer dealers expo, gradually lost its influence. And as things do in our industry, it lost favor, changed, was ultimately sold to a company called SoftBank. The money that came from that is what allowed Sheldon to get into the gambling industry. I've been privileged to follow the development of this industry for a long time. And Sheldon really did play a big role in its early stages of massive growth, because without COMDEX, it would have been much more difficult for the computer dealers to spring up in every small town. It would have been very difficult for people to know how to find the computers, the printers, those amazing green and amber monitors that we all use to type on. In order to develop the use of computers as something that's absolutely essential, I want to talk with my co-host now, because one of the things that was absolutely true was that in these days of the early part of the personal computer industry, there really were individuals that were identified with growth, from Jack Tramiel at Commodore to Bill Gates at Microsoft to people like Philippe Kahn at Borland. Individuals were critical, and many of these companies were based on the vision of those individuals. Now, it's hard to imagine a huge company growing up like that. And it's notable when one is. The main example right now seems to be Tesla and SpaceX, which are driven by the vision of a single individual. Lou, I want to talk to you first, because you are, of course, working for a company that was worth once heavily identified with a single individual. Do you think that today we could see the rise of a genre-changing computer business that was the vision of a single person, or has it grown to a point where it really does take a team to make something earth-shattering happen?
Actually, Lou's got some internet problems, but I'll take that question. The reality is there's always going to be room for an personality. You know, the Michael Dells of the world are not unique. There are other people like that. We've had some really, really interesting things happening in India. We've had some really interesting things happening in Hong Kong. And the industry is growing. You know, I had a conversation with my father many decades ago. He was saying he was in plumbing distribution, you know, the raw pipes and fixtures. He said if his industry has a 3% growth, they go out and throw a big party. And at that time, I was complaining. I was in regional distribution at the time. I was complaining that we didn't have 100% growth anymore. You know, he says, son, fact check. We only get a 3% and we have a big party. Now, I was involved with Comdex in the very early years, but at the distribution level. And one of the things about Comdex that a lot of people don't know is there was an awful lot of backroom deals and coordination and so forth. I actually was invited, because we're at the distribution level, to a meeting with Ray Norda of Novell. And at the time, there were only 10 distributors of Novell Network in the world. Well, old man Ingram, the founder of Ingram Distribution, which then merged and became Ingram Micro D, basically before all the Novell people got in, he stood up in front of the rest of us and said, I don't know about you folks, but I'm going to refuse to sell NetWare unless Novell lets us teach NetWare in our distribution facilities. And we all thought this was a great idea. And Ray Norda came in, handed us these beautiful CEO Club cross pens, Novell logo on the clip and everything. And then old man Norda came up and said, hey, this is what's going to happen, Ray. And after throwing several vice presidents under the bus, Ray finally said, okay, fine. Thusly, each distribution center was allowed to have a single instructor sent. And that's how I became one of the first 10 Novell instructors on Earth. One of the other things, I got to meet David Fry of Fry's Computers. Toshiba was such a huge thing that they took over the entire Hilton pool deck right up to the fire marshal limit for the Toshiba. So there was a lot of really interesting things. The industry was growing. And like I said, we were complaining if we didn't do 100% growth in a year. That was spawned by shows like Comdex, because the internet didn't exist yet. And the amount of coordination happening was spectacular. Now, Kurt, were you one of the people that arranged for the Cadillac size shrimp boat at Toshiba?
Toshiba wasn't mine, although I do remember the epic shrimp at Toshiba. You know, it is amazing that years later, the thing that a major Japanese manufacturer is noted for is not their hardware, not their peripherals, but the size of the crustaceans they served at their parties. They were massive. It was a different time. As Brian said, the margins were huge. The growth was phenomenal. And each company was trying to gain attention from other companies by throwing these incredible parties. Each night of Comdex, there would be multiple parties with touring rock bands performing on stage for a different group. I remember one year when the entertainment at the Microsoft party was helicopter rides over the strip in Las Vegas, where it looked like some sort of army operation with scores of helicopters coming in to land and take off at the Thomas and Mack Arena. The industry has grown. The industry has matured. And by and large, that's a great thing. What we should continue, though, is the energy and the idea that truly important things can be created that will change the world. It's something that fewer companies that I talk to have. I think that Lou's back, and I do want to give him a chance to come in because Lou's been around this industry and others. Lou, what do you think? Is the computer industry better as a responsible part of the economy since it is more mature these days, since we don't have everything driven by rugged individuals and wild imaginations?
I definitely think it's matured. I mean, I think you got a big tech companies that have been around for a while. They've been around the block and they know just how economies are running and just how businesses are expanding. And I think that they have matured enough that we see less usage. And you think about it, we see less usage in the enterprise for those types of individuals and those types of companies. So I definitely think that over time, you will continue to see it evolve. A lot more companies are doing responsible computing and they're doing, responsible info sharing. You know, obviously with the pandemic over the last year, you know, unfortunately you see less and less of these trade shows these offerings that, that a lot of us did love. Like you guys were reminiscing about, I did love going to these junkets and these different events where you get great food and great entertainment. But in the same sense, a lot of these companies are starting to realize, hey, like that's expensive for us to send people and we can still get the information remotely and we can still get it responsibly and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I definitely think it's matured and we'll continue to see it evolve, especially this year and the next year as things kind of progress.
It is going to be interesting to watch to see how we continue to evolve and to see how the individuals who remain continue to have an impact on the industry. Well, with that, it's time to get ready to talk to an individual who has started something and is leaning on his vision to keep it going. But before we do that, Lou, I think you have a sponsor to tell us about.
Indeed, I do. Thank you, Curtis. Next up, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. But before we get to that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Worldwide Technology, known simply as WWT. Now, WWT began building its Advanced Technology Center, ATC, 10 years ago, and it's grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab out there they've ever seen. Now, the lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners, ranging from high-tech heavyweights like HPE and Intel to disruptors like Equinix. Now, when you think about developing technologies or even testing deployments, you want to ensure you work with the company that you can trust, right? Well, WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Now, the ATC is an incubator for IT innovation, and it offers schedulable and on-demand labs like HPE's Primera Storage Lab. Plus, it has hundreds of other labs representing the newest advances in cloud-based machine learning and storage. You get to learn about products before you launch. Engineers at WWT use these environments to quickly spin up proof of concepts and pilots using the sandbox so customers can confidently select the best solutions. Now, in many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases your speed to market. Now, they offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here you can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. Plus, it's virtual, so you can actually take advantage of the ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. Now, engineers at WWT work in these labs every day. They are beta testing new solutions based on the latest and greatest HPE technologies. Plus, they're building reference architectures and custom integrations. These help their customers make decisions and see results faster with much less investment. Now, WWT has launched its new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. Now, this ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere in the world for its customers. Now, get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more and discover why organizations across industries turn to WWT to guide them on their digital transformation journey, visit WWT.com/TWIT. And don't forget to create a My WWT account to access resources available through WWT's Advanced Technology Center ecosystem. That's WWT.com/TWIT. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank Worldwide Technology for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on us. And today is no exception. We have a great guest. We welcome to TWIET CEO of Disco, Kiwi Kamara. Welcome to the show, Kiwi.
Thanks so much, Lou.
Now, Kiwi, now our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us on a short journey through tech and what brought you to Disco?
Sure. I studied computer science in college and then ultimately went to law school and became a lawyer. And I was very frustrated with the software we had available in our practice. It was clunky, difficult to use, slow, felt like kind of the 90s internet. And so ultimately we wound up building a set of internal solutions at my old law firm, loved them, spun it out, started selling to other people, and I made the jump into tech.
Fantastic. Now, we have a bunch of topics here to talk about today. I know one of them is compliance because it's a huge market. In fact, I did for Xerox recently. I did a talk for them on the importance of e-discovery and its requirements for pretty much any organization out there. Now, some people might not be familiar with the concept of e-discovery. Can you maybe take us through that and what it means?
Sure. So in litigation or investigations, when companies sue each other, or companies sue the government, the law requires people to go through all of their documents, email, messages, and find the ones that have to be produced to the other side. And so that's what e-discovery is. It's the process of lawyers going through millions or tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of documents in each of those cases or investigations and finding the ones that have to be produced because they might ultimately be evidence.
Right. Now, you know, obviously a lot of organizations, some of them don't have services that provide this. And so they tend to reach out when they're running into trouble or if they need some help, they run into organizations like forensic companies that come in. How does e-discovery kind of relate to forensic corporations, companies that kind of come in and look through the breadcrumbs and find all the data?
Yeah, so we do that work ourselves at Disco, and of course, many of our customers do that work also. If you think about the e-discovery process, there's really forensics on the left side, so collecting the data and finding the data in some cases from wherever it lives, then kind of processing the data, right? Extracting information from it, making it searchable, putting it in a form where lawyers can get access to it, and then the software that lawyers use to actually review and classify the documents, and then downstream production. So we think of forensics as kind of the entry point to our business.
Got it. Now, it sounds like a challenging thing, especially in the world of hybrid cloud, where you have online and on-prem environments at the same time. What are organizations doing to solve these challenges, especially with these types of environments?
You know, it's a big challenge for a lot of people. And historically, for the reasons you talked about, right, there's so many data sources and it's scattered everywhere. There was a big reliance on services companies. And so you would get folks like the Big Four or others in the space to come and build custom solutions, sometimes literally for every matter or every investigation, and find a way to go get the data, process it, and let the lawyers review it. And what we've seen over the past kind of 4 or 5 years is really the industry is moving away from that services heavy model to integrated products like DISCO that can do, you know, 95-100% of that using software.
It's interesting. So now let's talk about the integrated side of things, obviously, because obviously lots of organizations have different workflows. They have different services, data storage. They have lots of people sharing documents and data in different ways. Like obviously they have the more controlled ways of doing things where you have things like SharePoint or so on. But then you have, you know, other people in an organization that might be sharing things on social networks and third-party application services. Now, how does something like DISCO handle all of these kind of integrations and different touch points for data?
Yeah, that's the challenge, right? And I think it's also why you haven't seen one of the big vendors like Microsoft or Google address this problem, right? Because they would build tools for their own systems, but not for the hundreds of thousands of other systems that employees are using. And so really what we contribute as a company, companies like us, is we'll build connectors or ingest tools for each of those different data sources, right? There are the easy ones like email or Office documents or G Suite documents. And then there are the ones that are rising now, like Slack and social network posts and video and audio. And then surprising is old data, right? You have to remember that litigation can involve events that were 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so you've got to support, you know, the 90s versions of Word. So that's really one of the big pieces of the offering, is being able to ingest data in all those different forms and get it in a form where lawyers can review it.
Right. Well, since you brought it up, I did want to bring it up, the fact, obviously, like other companies, like cloud service companies like Microsoft, they do offer things like Microsoft's Advanced eDiscovery. Of course, they do it across all of their properties and locations. Now, you talked a little bit about how DISCO differentiates itself, especially with the ingest tools and the integrations. How else is DISCO differentiating itself from something like the Advanced Threat Protection, or I'm sorry, the Advanced eDiscovery?
So we actually don't compete with Microsoft Advanced eDiscovery. Most of the, call it, cloud systems of record, like a G Suite has a similar thing, and Slack has an eDiscovery API. And what those things are is what we connect to. Right. So they let a company like us go get data out of Office 365, and they let internal IT professionals or compliance professionals at companies do an initial kind of filtering of the data to go find what has to go to an e-discovery software company like us. So they're our friends, really. And it's not so much that we differentiate from them as that we sit to the right of them. And the reason you need somebody like us is because typically all your data isn't in any one of those platforms. It's not all in Microsoft. Some of it is elsewhere. And so we're the place where that data comes together for purposes of legal review.
Got it. So let's pivot a little bit and talk about the law side. I want, you know, from a law perspective, how is eDiscovery helping lawyers and helping law companies?
Well, most basically, we help lawyers find the facts. So if you think about any of the lawsuits or legal issues that you've read about in the news, right, things like the U.S. presidential election or the opioids epidemic or the 737 Max litigation in the U.K., the COVID response litigation. In all those cases, lawyers have to go figure out what happened. And the way they do that is by pouring through millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of documents, emails, chat messages, to go figure out what happened and to be able to prove it in court. And so what a system like DISCO does is make it really easy to do that, right? Make all those things searchable, make it easy to explore them, use AI to help push the most relevant things to the top. We help lawyers figure out what the facts are.
So let's talk a little bit about compliance, because obviously a lot of organizations are looking to make sure they're compliant and they're meeting some of the needs of some of the demands of a lot of the laws and regulations that are out there today. How is eDiscovery helping that, and, you know, especially lawyers and organizations alike?
Absolutely. So again, our software really helps anytime the lawyers need to look at what's going on in an organization. For example, in financial services, we have a variety of clients who actually load essentially all their communication data, right, chats, email, and so on, into DISCO in real time, so that whenever there's a question about trading compliance or, you know, communications with other market participants, it's very easy for the compliance department to jump into DISCO and go search and identify things that might present compliance issues. And again, those organizations can use what we call DISCO AI, but it's basically an automated classification system that can surface to the compliance department documents that might present compliance issues even before any lawyer has reviewed them.
I do want to bring my co-host back in, starting with Cheever, because Cheever, you've had some experience in the law side of things, in the sector of the market, right?
Yeah, the hilarious part is Kiwi actually worked at a law firm in Honolulu way back, and they were actually one of my customers. And I'll tell you, one of the challenges with discovery is you have documents. I mean, lots of them. How do you protect the privacy? Because there are privacy issues coming up, like GDPR, California privacy, FERPA, HIPAA, you name it. And discovery means you're looking at a lot of documents. What kinds of mechanisms do you have in place with your product to be able to protect the privacy of the people that you've done discovery on?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's been an increasing area of focus for many of our customers. And we do a range of things. We can do things, for example, filtering documents on ingest, automatically applying redactions to things that we recognize as credit card numbers or driver's license numbers or really any other category of personally identifiable information. We can do things using DISCO AI to automatically surface documents that seem to be medical records or documents that seem to contain, you know, otherwise sensitive information. And so we can help, again, help lawyers accelerate the process of kind of complying with those laws. You know, in the UK, GDPR has just been a huge part of our business over there as companies struggle to figure out how to comply with all these data subject access requests in a way that's efficient.
Kiwi, when I have talked to people in the legal services and support for legal services industries, they've talked about the fact that most law firms in North America are small groups, probably five attorneys or fewer. So when you are looking at what you provide at DISCO, is it available to smaller firms, or is what you're doing really only there for the very large firms?
Well, we work with firms of all sizes. Really, it's not so much the size of the law firm that determines whether they need us. It's the size of their clients, right? So a very big trend that we've seen in the legal industry is you may have lawyers who start their careers at a really big law firm, thousands of lawyers, and then they may partner there and they develop a book of business, and then they and a small group of their friends decide to leave and start a small firm. Well, that firm might have only three or four or five lawyers, but it represents, you know, Bank of America, Deutsche Bank, Southwest Airlines, whoever it may be, really big clients. And it's more the size of the client that drives whether someone needs us than the size of the law firm.
All right. So just to be clear, when we're talking about the software that you have and what it can do for a firm, this is not something that you would see the stereotypical Matlock type lawyer and firm using. This really is, as you say, for those who have clients with substantial issues, substantial cases, and substantial stacks of both physical and electronic documents that might need to be handled for their casework.
It's definitely for cases that involve lots of documents, but it's not always for big companies. So think about environmental cases or the U.S. opioids litigation is a good example, right? The plaintiffs in those cases are just people. They're ordinary individuals, but they have to go through tens of millions of documents that are produced by the folks on the other side, whether they're drug companies or chemical companies or whatever it may be. And so those individuals have a need for our software to go through very big collections of documents. And so it's really just any time the subject matter of the case involves lots of documents, you're going to need e-discovery.
So I've got a question. Your website talks about being able to leverage the Google's Word2Vec system. And this brings up a question, you know, discovery isn't just Word documents or text messages or emails. Sometimes it's engineering drawings, sometimes it's engineering documents, but you still need to do discovery on it. You still need to have something to massage it. Could you tell us how you leverage Word2Vec and how do you deal with this type of technical language?
Absolutely. So that is part of the system that we call Disco AI. And the basic goal of Disco AI is let's observe how lawyers are classifying the documents they look at, and then let's train an AI model to predict how they would classify the millions of documents that they haven't looked at yet, so that we can push the documents that are most likely to be what the lawyers are looking for to the top. And what Word2Vec lets us do is go take a document, extract its text, and then extract the meaning of that text so that we can use the similarity of two documents in terms of their meaning to recommend the second one to the lawyer if the lawyer has said the first one is relevant. That's sort of how it works at the highest level. It's a lot like how Netflix recommends movies to you based on the movies that you've already watched.
So Kiwi, we're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to ask you one more thing about just cloud integration. Now, do you integrate with some of the big cloud offerings out there, like for instance AWS, Azure, IBM Cloud, that kind of thing, or is it limited? How what are the different integration touch points for cloud services and data storage?
Yeah, so we collect, if you think about our clientele, right, it's you know, big legal department, the legal departments of big companies in pretty much every major industry. And so they store data in, you know, on-prem, in every cloud service you can imagine, and so on. And so we work with all of those, you know, we're just agnostic about the source of the data. That depends on the IT decisions that the client has made. And what we offer is the ability to go take that data in whatever format it's in, wherever it lives today, and get it into a central place, extract information from it, and create a tool that lawyers can use to review the documents. So we work with everybody.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, unfortunately, all good things come to an end. Kiwi, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but I do want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can learn more about Disco and where they can go get started.
Of course. We'd love you to visit www.csdisco.com. Disco is short for discovery. We like to think we make it a shorter process. We'd love to work with anybody who faces the problem of identifying legally important documents in big collections. We find we can help clients reduce the cost of that by 20 to 30% and really help them get on with their lives instead of focusing on litigation. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thanks again. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you online?
Well, I'm going to be doing things around the analysis of different trends and what it means for companies when they're faced with, well, the kind of news that companies have been faced with the past few weeks. I will always point to that over on Twitter, so please follow me at KG4GWA. If you want to see pretty pictures along with it, you can follow me on Instagram at Kurt_Franklin. Would love to take your suggestions, your comments, because all of this is about getting the best information into your hands. That's why we do Twyatt. Funny how that works out.
Thanks, Curtis. Indeed, indeed. We also have to thank Mr. Brian Chee. Cheebert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you?
I am waiting on pins and needles to find out how fast this house sells. But you know what? In the meantime, I'm still booking shows. I'm still trying to find all kinds of really cool content to share with our viewers. To that end, I'm on Twitter. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And, you know, the other way is you can also throw some email at me. I'm Cheebert, Cheebert, at twit.tv. But you know what? Why don't you send it to Twyatt at twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you, good or bad. We have developed relatively thick skin, so go at it. You know, everybody has their opinion, maybe. But, you know, we love hearing from you. We've gotten some amazing show ideas from our viewers, and we'd love to hear from you. And, you know, I want to say a big shout out to our download viewer at McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Hey, man, take care.
Thanks, Cheebert. Well, we also have to thank you as well, especially the one in Antarctica, to the person who drops in each and every week to listen to our show to get your enterprise and IT news goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and to catch up on your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the show notes, information for the co-hosts, guest information, of course, links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices and any one of your podcast applications. We're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and enjoy our show. Now, the best way, it's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise on IT news. But if you have to subscribe, you should, you know, impress your friends, your family, your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because we talk a lot about fun topics here on Twyatt, and I'm sure that they'll find them interesting as well. So definitely have them subscribe as well. Now, after you subscribe, we do this show live each and every week, 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. You can check us out at live.twit.tv. There you can see how the pizza's made, how the show is run, all the fun stuff and the banter that we do behind the scenes. Definitely check that out if you're available. And if you're available live, you might as well jump in the chat room live as well. We have a great set of characters in there. IRC.twit.tv. We get some really great questions and some content from them. So definitely jump in there and enjoy the discussion. Now, if you can't watch the show live and you can't be part of the discussion live, that's okay, because we still have an amazing, great community out there at our amazing website at twit.community. That's twit.community. It's a 24/7 discussion. It's a great community location. All the hosts are out there. The community's out there. We have some great discussions over shows, content, guests, technology, all the fun stuff. So come out and join the twit.community. It's 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. I have some great conversations with people like you. Plus, I post a little bit about my day job at Microsoft, where we talk about how we can customize Office to make it better and easy for your organization. You can check that out at developers.microsoft.com/office. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, because without them, we couldn't do this show, especially to Leah and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week. We couldn't do the enterprise this week in enterprise tech without them. So thank you for all their support. I also want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. And of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. And he does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Cheebert, for all your support and all of your help over the years. And before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, Mr. Victor. Victor, thank you so much for all your support and making us look good. And of course, our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, what's going on for you in the coming weeks over there at Twit?
Oh, I have a lot of fun scheduled for everybody to subscribe to my show, Hands On Photography. That's twit.tv/hop. Can't wait to share it.
Say thank you, Annie. If you definitely want to learn some amazing tactics around photography, definitely subscribe, because I sure have learned some stuff. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maruska, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.